We'll be talking this morning with a sociologist who has lived and worked among the Amish, and he's written a book about them. The title of the book is The Riddle of Amish Culture. Our guest is Donald Krehbill. He teaches at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. The book is set in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, which is the home of the oldest surviving Amish settlement in the world. It is also the world's most densely populated Amish settlement. And it is quite an interesting book. It offers a view, I think, into a society that ordinarily one would not get. And as he suggests in the book, also it gives us an opportunity to think a little bit more about our own values as we study and get acquainted with the values of the Amish. This book, The Riddle of Amish Culture, is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Donald Krehbill is winner of the National Religious Book Award for The Upside Down Kingdom. Among his other books are Perils of Professionalism, Facing Nuclear War, and Our Star-Spangled Faith. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, of course, you folks who are listening are invited to call in. Maybe you'll have some questions. The telephone number here is 333-9455, and toll-free if you're outside of Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere that you hear us, you can use the toll-free number. That is 800-222-9455. Professor Krehbill, good morning.
Hello, David.
Thank you very much for being with us.
It's very good to be with you.
I'd like to ask first if you would talk a little bit about what your how your interest began drawn to be drawn to the Amish, and why you were interested in studying them and writing about them.
Well, I grew up here in Lancaster County. Actually, grew up on a farm with Mennonite parents, and so I lived side by side with the Amish since my childhood. And as a sociologist, I'm interested in different groups and different cultures, and the Amish experience in their struggle with modernization was very fascinating, so it seemed like a natural thing for me.
Maybe you might give a little bit of history of the Amish and where they came from, how they came to the United States, and what are some of the major beliefs that they live by.
They're theological and historical roots go back to Europe, to the 16th century. They were part of what is known as a radical reformation that broke off from the major Protestant Reformation in 1525. They were part of a group called Anabaptists for a number of years. That term was given to the group as a nickname because they believed in adult baptism. And at that time, most of, including the Protestants, most of the churches were baptizing children as infants. And the Anabaptists argued that only adults should be baptized after they make an adult voluntary decision. Out of that group sprang a number of particular groups, the Hutterites, the Mennonites, the Amish. And the Amish emerged as a separate and distinct group in 1693, in southern Germany, and actually what today is the Alsace region of France. They immigrated to the United States in the early 1700s, 1720s and 1730s, and became farmers in Pennsylvania, and then eventually moved on to Ohio and Indiana, and even today in Illinois. Today they're scattered across the United States in 20 different states, and a total about 175 different settlements in those 20 different states, as well as the Canadian province of Ontario.
You explain that if you want to understand Amish culture, there is a German word that one must understand, and not just understand it literally, but understand it in the fullness of its meaning.
Yes.
And the word is Gelassenheit. I don't know.
Gelassenheit, yes.
My pronunciation is up to it. Tell us, what does that mean, and in what ways do you see this in Amish life?
Perhaps the quickest way to get a grasp of what Gelassenheit is to say what it's not. It's the opposite of aggressive and assertive individualism. Essentially, Gelassenheit refers to the relationship between an individual and a group. And Gelassenheit, translated, would mean yieldedness, submission, subordination, humility, obedience to a larger collective order, as over against aggressive, assertive individualism. Gelassenheit is expressed in many different ways in Amish culture. One way would be in the body language. If you meet an Amish person, you normally would not aggressively shake their hand like you might in American culture. The body language is slower. You walk slower. You talk slower. You don't interrupt people or butt in a conversation as quickly. So part of it would be expressed simply in the body language of the individual. Secondly, it would be expressed in the values of the culture, simplicity, humility, concern for obedience to those in authority. The simplicity and humility would be expressed in the form of dress that one wears, darker colors, quiet colors. It would be expressed in technology, rejecting some modern forms of technology. Also, it would be expressed in the Amish taboo against photography, of not taking photographs of individuals and putting them up on the wall where they would be on display, which would be seen as a form of arrogance and pride and being haughty. So the Gelassenheit is really expressed in many ways throughout the culture, also in the organizational structure. There's no bureaucracy in Amish society, no large central organization, no central denominational offices, no executive secretary or executive board of directors or this kind of thing, but rather a decentralized, informal, loosely coupled organizational structure. So those are some of the many ways in which Gelassenheit gets translated into practical terms in Amish society.
Mm. One might get the idea from that, and I think it would be an incorrect idea, that there is that one Amish person, one man or one woman, is just like the next. And I at least as my feeling from having read your book, that that's really not true. There is some room for individuality. Each person is not just like the next. But
yes,
it's perhaps it's expressed in a much more subtle way than one might in the modern world.
Right. That's you're very correct, David, in that observation. The thing that's tricky is that from the outside, you see people driving carriages with horses. You see the standards of dress and the costume look very similar, and that may lead to the erroneous impression that they are all identical and cut out from some large cultural cookie cutter. But in fact, there's a great deal of variation by personality type, of course, a great deal of variation in temperament, and a great deal of room for individual freedom. In terms of an Amish woman, what she plants in her garden, or an Amish farmer, what he plants in the field, a great deal of variation here, freedom. So individuality, yes, but individualism, no. The kind of thing that would be frowned upon is when an individual elevates him or herself above the group or above other people and says, look at me, I'm better than you are, trying to call attention to himself.
Mm-hmm. Something else that an outside observer might think or might imagine would be that to the Amish, their way of life might seem oppressive because there are a great many limitations. There are just certain things that one just does not do. Did you ever find that, or is that again a misconception that an outsider might have?
Well, that's a good but difficult question. I have talked to some Amish persons who I think do feel the limitations, particularly in terms of education, where they are forbidden to go on to high school and forbidden, of course, to go to college or higher education. And I've talked to some people who have felt, you know, boy, I'd really like to go on to high school or college, and they have felt the oppressiveness of that limitation. On the other hand, there's enormous amount of freedom that's brought about by the discipline, and I point this out in the last chapter of the book where I talk about a dialogue between modern society and Amish society. At first glance, one might think that the Amish feel very limited by their clothing. Only certain styles and certain colors are acceptable, but that frees them from enormous amount of shopping trips. It frees them from trying to worry about keeping up to date with the latest fads. It frees them from worrying about how they look and matching their colors all the time. So in the midst of the discipline and in the midst of the limits, there is also enormous amount of freedom. again, with the education, no, they're not free to go on to college, but because they haven't gone on to college, they tend to find their employment either on the farm or in small cottage industries. So that means they're free to be at home with their families. They're free to walk across the driveway to have lunch with their families. They're free from commuting on the expressway. And inside those limits, there's a great deal of freedom, and I would say a great deal of contentment and satisfaction with their way of life.
Our guest this morning on Focus is Donald Krehbiel. He's a sociologist. He teaches at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. We're talking with him about his book, The Riddle of Amish Culture. And if you have questions, you're invited to call 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that's remarkable, I think, that seems to me at any rate, remarkable about the Amish is the fact that the attrition rate is so low. I think you mentioned in your book that chances are good that four of every five Amish children will remain Amish. And one wonders that with the kind of pull the outside world, you can imagine the outside world having, as we have seen, for example, so many people from rural areas pulled to the bigger cities, and, you know, people sort of lamenting that somehow their children aren't interested in preserving the values that they have. How it is that the Amish have not only maintained a steady state, but they have grown, and that they don't lose very many people to the modern world. What is it that somehow holds people in this society and keeps them there?
Well, I think there's several factors. The first one that I would point to would be their own educational system. And the way that is set up is that an Amish child attends a small one-room school that's operated by the Amish community. There are usually 30 children in the schoolroom, grades 1 through 8, and an Amish teacher teaches them. That means that they are not exposed to the values of modern society. It also means they're not developing close friendships with the outside world. And it also means that their education is limited at 8th grade, so they don't engage in critical thinking or scientific study, and they don't go on to professions that would require mobility. So essentially, the educational system insulates them from both the values and social interactions with the surrounding society, and it also inadvertently limits them from certain occupations that would take them away from the community. Secondly, the Amish community, at least here in Pennsylvania, in recent years has developed a lot of different cottage industries so that there's employment for Amish persons who work off of the farm in a variety of occupations that are inside an Amish context. That is, the people that they're working with day in and day out in a small cottage industry and crafts and so on, small manufacturing shops, are other Amish persons. And that means they're inside an Amish world, essentially, and not directly interacting with the outside world. So those are two of the factors. I think a third factor is that the church does exert considerable control over the lifestyle. And so if someone is disobedient to that, they would be excommunicated and eventually socially avoided or socially ostracized, or what we sometimes call shunning. So those are some of the factors, David, that I think come together to help keep the children in the community. And as you did point out, roughly four out of five stay in the community. And that means with about seven children on the average per family, they have a rapidly growing population. And it's increasing very, very rapidly.
Mm-hmm. The numbers of I noted some of them down, and I thought it was just astounding how large the families can get, and then how the family how big these families can get, the extended families are so large it's not unusual for a couple to have 45 grandchildren. A typical child may have two dozen aunts and uncles and as many as 75 first cousins.
That's correct.
That's astounding.
Yeah, and it's just dramatically different from modern life where we might have two or three first cousins, and those first cousins that we have might be in four or five, or in different states. Whereas the bulk of these 75 first cousins for the Amish child might live within 10 miles away.
We have a couple of callers here we'd like to bring into our conversation, and of course, people who are listening are invited. We have a couple local lines open. The number is 333-9455. We'll go first to our toll-free line here, number four.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
A while back, I went with a group to a place in southern Illinois called Arthur, Illinois, and this was an Amish community also, and we were impressed with the fact they didn't have any farm machinery, but the farms were, or the land was tilled and planting and so on by with horses, and but it was beautiful. Their land and their farmlands that they work under those conditions were so noticeably great. However, you mentioned the fact about the limited education, and they just had them go to a little school they had there for, a few years. I don't know, maybe it was even 8 years. I can't give it specifically, but not very much. But they were perfectly content that way. But coming home, it was a bus group. Coming home on the bus, we were all kind of sad because we were thinking maybe that some of those kids that were so limited, maybe one could have been a doctor, or something, great person. But was so, hindered in that way. That's all I have to say.
Well, that's a good point you raise. And when I teach the Amish culture in my classrooms, we often talk about that question. In fact, I deal with it in the book in the last chapter. What about the human potential that's being wasted here? What about the airplane pilots and the doctors and lawyers that perhaps are hidden in the Amish community? The dilemma is that once you allow higher education and once you permit them to go on to college and pursue those occupations, it really literally would destroy the community. And the downside of American individualism and the downside of that freedom is that we have many trips to the psychiatrist's office and therapist's office, and in Amish society, with a greater deal of control and less focus on individual achievement, and a strong emphasis on being part of a group and cooperating with the group, you simply have less of those emotional and mental problems that spin off from modern life. But that's an interesting observation, and it certainly is true.
Hmm. I'm curious about having you talk about something a little bit different, but springs off from the caller's question, because she was talking about the fact that the Amish farmers do use horses. They use some kinds of machinery on their farm, but they still do a lot of their pulling work with horses, and of course they don't have cars. They use their horse and buggy. Would though, if one was to have the opportunity to go into an Amish home, do you think that most people would be surprised at how quote unquote modern it was, and the kinds of things that they did have that you would find in probably anybody's house?
Yes, I think that's true, David. Particularly here in the Lancaster, Pennsylvania settlement, the newer Amish homes are quite modern. You find modern cabinets in the homes. All of them have modern bathroom facilities. They have linoleum, the kind that's permanently waxed, formica in the countertops. Really, everything is very modern, with the exception of electricity. You don't have a doorbell, you don't have a television, you don't have a radio, you don't have an electric toaster or a VCR or a microwave, but everything else would feel quite modern. And many people have the misconception that they don't have bathrooms in the house, and that simply is not true. The water is heated by gas, so there's hot running water, and there would be showers and bathroom facilities just like anyone else. Now, the pattern inside the homes does vary a great deal from settlement to settlement. And in some of the more rural areas of other states, there may be situations where the homes would not be as up-to-date. So there is variation, but these people are not cooking over an open fire, and they're not milking, generally not milking their cows by hand.
Okay, let's talk with some other folks here. Let's go to line number one.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say something about the Amish community we have in Arthur and Tuscola in that area, and ask you a question. We've gone down there a number of times, and the first thing we found confusing, and maybe you can speak about it, since you said you came from a Mennonite home, is the fact that the Mennonites drove cars. There is a confusion, in other words, about who the Mennonites are, who the Old Order Amish are, and that would be helpful for I know I had to figure it out and do some reading to find that out, because there are different customs, even though in some ways there are things that are alike. Secondly, I just wanted to say, too, we visited there. I remember once going to one of the school houses and found it extraordinarily interesting. We spoke to the teacher. There was no skulking around behind trees and peeking out and making them objects of some kind of exotic native sect. And the children were, again, extraordinarily friendly and nice. The people were that we met in town. There was no, you know, they don't like to be stared at. I think they don't like to be photographed. There's a sense of privacy, which anybody would want. So I think that kind of thing is interesting. But then I did reading and spoke to some of those people and found it very interesting that in recent times there's more alcoholism. They said in this community there's vandalism. They've had a lot of problems with their teenagers. And I was told something I hadn't ever known. Now, maybe I'm wrong, that the young people, and I wasn't sure if it's just the boys, have to choose to be Amish at the age of 21 or whatever it was, but before that they can even have cars. Now, maybe someone was giving me information or I'm mixed up, but maybe you can talk about the problems that are arising in these communities now, because I was really surprised at some of the major problems that they've had, even though it isn't major, not in the sense of our own society.
Yeah, so I'll be happy. Let me first of all comment on the cars. It is very confusing between the different Amish and Mennonite groups. There are actually several different Mennonite groups. Some are quite progressive and, of course, would use cars and modern technology and dress just like everyone else. Then there are some Old Order Mennonite groups that would, several different ones that would have different practices as far as using tractors or cars. The Old Order Amish would be the most conservative of the Amish, and then there are also some New Order Amish groups. Typically, the Old Order Amish would prohibit the ownership of cars. Now, they do in some settlements here in Pennsylvania, for example, they are permitted to use cars, that is, to have someone drive them around. They have persons that make their living by taxiing Amish to different places for business and sales and funerals and so on. But the rule of thumb is that they are not allowed to own the cars nor to drive them. And basically, they're trying to control individualism because a car really represents automatic mobility. It's an automobile is automatic mobility. And if you want to control individuals and keep them at home and prevent individualism, the last thing you want to do is give somebody the keys to a car. So
I found some on bikes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Now, let me speak to the young people. Basically, the Amish community has emphasized adult baptism. And so typically, here in Pennsylvania at least, the girls would be baptized between 16 and 18 years of age, the boys 19 to 21 or 22 years of age. And they must be baptized in the church before they can be married. So what often happens is young boys will be running around, and often here at least it's referred to as quote-unquote sowing your wild oats, being a little wild and so on. But they have to join the church and be baptized before they're allowed to be married, and frequently they will be baptized in October and then will get married in November and become settle down and become part of the church. Now, before they are baptized, the church has really no control over them. In other words, they can't be excommunicated, they can't be disciplined, because they really are not fully a member of the church at that point. And so the church really has no legal jurisdiction over them. So you do have some aberrations. You have young people owning cars. You have them going to dances and movies. You do have some alcoholism among young people. There are parties here. You know, where they'll have some kegs of beer and so on. And so that time of sowing the wild oats is typical. But the surprising thing is that most of them do settle down when they're 21 or 22. They do join the church. They become baptized and usually grow up to become very faithful and cooperative adults. Now, in the book, I have several pages where I talk about the sowing the wild oats, and I don't have time here, but I do think there's a sociological principle behind it that explains it, that sowing the wild oats gives the young people at least the impression that they have a choice. And one might argue they really don't have a choice because they've grown up in Amish schools and they've been socialized through Amish institutions, and it's not a real choice. But nevertheless, it gives them the impression of a choice. And that, later in adult life, I think is helpful to make them more compliant and submissive to the church.
We are about midway through here. I need to jump in. I want to talk about the programs we have scheduled in the next couple of days, and then we'll go on and we'll take another phone call. Our guest this morning is Donald Craybill. He is a sociologist.
They help with minor manufacturing or carpentry or whatever the cottage industry is, and they aren't going on to higher education. So my sense is that they likely will be able to continue to have large families even if they aren't on the farm, because they need a labor supply of manual labor for these small cottage industries.
Thank you. You haven't heard of any discrimination, say, in North Dakota or anything like that?
I've heard some of that by way of gossip in the grapevine. I cannot comment on that in terms of any official. I mean, I'm not close to it firsthand, but I have heard about it.
That's all I've heard, too. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let me ask you, Professor Craybill, when you talk about the fact that now many people, many Amish men, and I guess a good number of single Amish women are employed not in agriculture but in other kinds of occupations in cottage industry, even some, they even have some retail businesses. How do they decide what kind of job it would be appropriate to do and what would not? Obviously, there's a there are some lines that are drawn there.
That's correct. Things that are prohibited by the church in terms of their religious ordinances and religious doctrine would be also off limits or taboo as far as occupations. For example, to have televisions are not acceptable, nor are computers, nor are automobiles. So if you had a TV repair shop, or if you were retailing computers, or if you were waxing cars or selling cars, I mean, those things would be off limits simply because they would be forbidden by the religious doctrine in the community. On the other hand, a chainsaw, which is acceptable to use, you could have a little hardware shop and sell a chainsaw, and that wouldn't be a problem. So basically, things that are acceptable for use within the community, it would be acceptable to sell those in a retail fashion. But again, things that would not be acceptable within the community, one wouldn't be able to sell those. For instance, certain kinds of clothing. You know, an Amish person wouldn't sell bikinis in a dry goods store. It would really go along the lines of where the cultural lines have been drawn. In terms of what's acceptable within the church and what's not.
Mm-hmm. Let me just follow up on that, because it gets into an interesting area, and then I will get back to the phones because the lines are all filled and I have many people here who want to ask questions. But again, this business of drawing lines is a very curious one, and one of the many riddles that you talk about in the book is the riddle of technology. And we have talked about the kinds of, some of the things that Amish people have in their lives and some that they don't, and it is sometimes perplexing about how they make these decisions. And there are many examples in your book, and you've talked about some of them, examples like Amish people are allowed to ride in a car, but they won't drive, they won't own one. They can use a public phone, but they don't have phones in their house. They won't have electricity coming into their house by power lines, but things that are powered by batteries are okay. They don't have computers, but you could have a battery-operated calculator. You could operate a store, and you could have a modern electric cash register, but no electric light. And these kind of examples can go on and on. And the question one keeps coming back to is, how do they make these decisions? How do they decide what is acceptable and what is not?
Well, let me first of all say, David, that one of my central arguments of the book is that these riddles, so to speak, are not foolish or stupid. They perplex us and they seem weird to us on the outside. But in most cases, these are negotiated compromises with modern world. That is, what we have here are bargains, compromises that a traditional group has struck with modern life, with modernity. And so often there are economic forces that bring these about, and so the Amish, in a sense, are sitting across a bargaining table, and they've said, we'll go so far but no further, and the outcome of that compromise looks like a perplexing riddle to us. How the decisions are made is and it's difficult to describe quickly, there's a group of bishops that meets twice a year, and they kind of keep an eye on things, and the decisions really would be made in those meetings of the bishops, and then the decisions would be taken back to local congregations for a vote of ratification. So the bishops are really the leaders with authority in the community, and they would be the ones that really draw the lines and decide when a new technological intervention or technological apparatus would be detrimental to the community or would hurt the community or be a disadvantage to it.
Hmm. It's fascinating. Well, I better not keep my callers waiting here. Let's go back to the phones. Line 3. Next. Hello.
Yes, I was wondering, what do the Amish do when they need medical attention? In particular, since they have so many children, do the women go to the hospital to have their child, or do they stay at home, or what's the situation?
Yeah. Let me pick up first on child bearing. And this would vary community by community, and so I'm only speaking for the Lancaster, Pennsylvania community of about 16,000 now. Here, it's an interesting story because in the 50s and 60s, Amish women were going to hospitals to deliver their babies. In the last 15 years, there's been a dramatic shift back to home delivery, and about 90% of the Amish babies now would be delivered at home through the assistance of a certified and trained midwife. There are several midwives who are not Amish, but from the outside community who have proper training, and they would go around house to house, home by home, to deliver the babies. A few babies are delivered in a doctor's office, in a clinic beside a doctor's office, and a few would go to the hospital, but very few would go to the hospital. In terms of medical care, they do use modern medicine. They do use modern vaccines. They do use doctor services. They will go to the hospital. I would say generally they would be more like a rural peasant people in the sense that they would not run to the doctor every time they have a cold or their nose bleeds. They're just going to be more reticent and more reluctant to go to the doctor, but they will go and use modern medicine. They do go to hospitals. They would be reluctant to have a lot of expensive, advanced, modern surgery, for instance, open heart surgery, that kind of thing. They would tend to let nature take its course rather than to intervene with a very expensive, high-tech intervention.
All right, let's go to another caller, line number 1. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Hello. I'm struck by this sociologist's seeming lack of objectivity with respect to his own values. He seems to suggest, to me anyway, that's the way I hear it, that modern civilization, modern lifestyle is the norm. And, for example, he talks about how the Amish want to control individualism by keeping them from cars. Well, who the hell are you to promote individualism as an ultimate value?
Well, I'm not promoting it. I'm sorry. What about
you talk about wasted talents of people who don't get beyond an eighth grade education? Who the hell are you to talk about wasted talents?
I think you may be misunderstanding Professor Krehbiel. I'm not sure he took that kind of position. Maybe you'd like to talk about that.
Well, you talk about insufficient education. You know, there's a lot more to education than just reading, writing, and arithmetic. Your idea, it seems to me like you want to have these people socialized to
the
modern world.
Sir, you are completely misunderstanding me. I'm really, if you read the book, you'd find that I really am arguing against a lot of the values of modern life, and I'm certainly not in any way arguing for modern individualism. I'm trying to tell the Amish story, and I'm trying to tell how they have coped with some of those values, and I'm afraid you're completely misunderstanding me.
Let's go on here to another caller. Let's go to line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Am we on?
Yes.
I wanted to make a comment about the Mennonites in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
The Mennonites in Illinois have been here basically about 150 years. They're located principally in Tazewell, McLean, Livingston, and McLean counties. They originally were also Amish, according to a book by Steve Estes, who's the minister at the Hopedale Mennonite Church, and has done a lot of research on the Mennonites in Illinois. They originally were Hessians and Alsatians like those that came to Pennsylvania, but they came about 150 years later. This community of Mennonites in Illinois is very substantial. It's much larger than the small group of Amish that lived down at Arthur. So I wanted to explain that to your listeners.
Okay, well, we appreciate that. Professor Crapel, did you have anything you might want to add that to that?
Not really. I'm not familiar with the community out there, so I really can't add anything. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, I thank you for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go on to another caller, line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm enjoying this so much. I've always had a great admiration for the Amish people, having some of my ancestors been Amish, the Hochstetlers and the Schrocks in Pennsylvania. But one thing, we have a settlement in northern Indiana, and a few years ago they would not compromise when the state wanted them to put the yellow triangles on their buggies as a sign, you know, a slow-moving vehicle sign, and they would not compromise, and they sold their land and went down to Central America, to Belize, I believe. And it was unfortunate. I really hated to see that community go from our state. But evidently the state wouldn't back down, and the Amish people wouldn't, you know, they did not want that on their horse and buggies. Now, we still have some that stayed, but one particular group went down there, and I hated to see them go.
Well, I think it's important for the listeners to understand that there is a great deal of variation from settlement to settlement and state to state, and there's no unified, centralized Amish structure to make decisions like that.
Right.
Each local community and each local church district really makes up its own mind.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently in this case, they decided to migrate rather than to buckle under the to the pressure of that putting that slow-moving vehicle sign on.
Yes.
In the Lancaster community, most of the churches have cooperated with that, and most of the black buggies here do have a large orange reflective triangle sign on the buggy, but in some other states it's been a problem, and it is decided state by state by each little local settlement.
One thing they have too is that their newspaper, the I'm forgetting the name of it now, but I have
the
seen
budget
the budget. Yes, it's such an interesting newspaper to read and to get a hold of some of the way they live. And the way they help each other out when there's a fire or a widow who, you know, asks for help and she gets it, and their lack of insurance, and I just admire their lifestyle. I think it's good that you wrote this book.
Well, thank you.
And I hope you don't take offense at the other caller, because he certainly was off base.
Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call. We have just about 6 or 7 minutes left and several callers. We'll try to get in as many people as we can. We're talking this morning with Donald Crabill. He is a professor of sociology at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania and is the author of the book, The Riddle of Amish Culture. We'll continue to take calls here, or we'll go back to the phones with line number 3. Hello.
Yes, I guess I, along with one of the callers previous, do disagree probably with the terms that you've been using, reticent, as far as not going to doctors. I guess I would have to say they're independent and self-sufficient. They take care of themselves. They don't run right away when something goes wrong. So therefore, I guess I would have to disagree with that term. Also, they're way ahead of us in their way that they farm. And we've had several programs just on this last year on this same station where people in Iowa and even here at the University of Illinois are getting in with this new terminology. They now call it non-biochemical farming. Well, the Amish are way ahead of us.
Well,
they know how to live and be comfortable within nature.
It is important to realize there is some variation across Amish communities on that. For example, in the Pennsylvania community here, the Amish do use chemical fertilizers. They do use pesticides, and they're using as many chemicals as the other farmers are using. Now, that may vary from settlement to settlement, but there's not a taboo in their religious doctrine against the use of chemicals.
Okay, let's go on to, again, another caller here, line number 1. Hello.
Hello, good day.
Yes.
Yes, I you'll have to forgive me if my knowledge is shallow. All I know is what I saw from the movie Witness, but I was kind of awestruck by their commitment, at least how it was portrayed in the movie. Having a religious background myself, I was kind of curious if you could enlighten me on some of the doctrinal basis for their beliefs.
I'm not quite sure where to start. I would say what you saw in Witness is a fairly accurate portrayal of Amish values in terms of the Amish side of it. Of course, the violence and the nudity and so on was very objectionable to them. In terms of their religious values, there would be an emphasis on the New Testament, an emphasis on pacifism, taking the words of Jesus literally, of loving one's enemy. There would be a strong emphasis on mutual aid, of cooperation and sharing within the community. They do not have communal property. That is to say, they do have private property, but there's a strong emphasis on sharing it together. Their religious experience is more oriented in a collective way rather than a high degree of emphasis on personal salvation or personal devotions or personal things, all of which have an individualistic tone and flavor to them.
I see. Okay, well, thank you. That was very interesting.
All right. I thank you for the call. Again, we'll go on to someone else. Line number two next. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Hello.
Yes.
I appreciate the fact that what you said earlier about the fact that there is freedom in limitations. I think that you find that by limiting yourself to a particular study of sociology, that you found freedom to do what you're doing now. And there is only freedom by limiting yourself in certain ways. We in modern society limit ourselves in certain ways so that we can be free to do other things as well. I was wondering if you happen to have any opinion on the effect of shunning on their attrition rate. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I would say the effect of shunning is important, and I think does help to keep people in the community. So the use of shunning, I think, does decrease the attrition rate. That is, it helps to keep more people in the community. So I think it is, although it's not used a lot, it is an important device of social control, which has helped to increase their growth and has helped to keep the community together. So it has functioned in a positive way for the community.
Another caller here, line number four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I just got on the tail end of this conversation, so I hope what I say isn't going to be redundant. I'm from northeastern Indiana,
mm-hmm.
and I enjoy traveling around the country. And I've seen around the Amish communities of Pennsylvania, here in Indiana, and Arthur. And there hasn't been one that I don't feel I wouldn't enjoy living in their area. Is it the impact of the Amish, or just what? What came first, the chicken or the egg? Just seems where you have an Amish community, everything else looks prosperous. Very strange. And another thing is, though, I understand there's a problem with the Amish communities in marrying often there's a problem of people marrying relatives. I understand it's a problem here in Indiana. Does the doctor have any comment about that?
Yeah, let me speak to the comment on the prosperity of the communities. I'm not sure which comes first here, the chicken or the egg. I think the Amish have a sense of seeking out good soil. I mean, they're very interested in the kind of soil where they can raise good crops. And then they tend to be conscientious and frugal and practical and do, generally speaking, take good care of the soil and take care of their barns and houses and so on. So I'm not sure which way it goes there. It's kind of a hard one to sort out. And I forgot the second question. I'm sorry.
It was a question concerning are there problems, any sorts of problems
okay.
that come up with marrying close relatives?
I'm not sure. There is the tendency in some of the communities for second cousins to marry and third cousins and so on. Generally, first cousins aren't married to each other. I don't know about your particular community out there in Arthur, what the situation is, but I am not aware of unique problems developing because of that. Obviously, if there are recessive genes that have a certain genetic deformity or something that's being passed on, that's going to be amplified if it's coming from both sides. But I don't believe, in terms of my genetic friends, what I know, that there's any unique problems that are generated spontaneously simply because second or third cousins are marrying.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of the time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate you giving us your time this morning.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And for those who are interested in getting more into this topic, you might take a look at the book that we have been talking about. Our guest is Donald Krehbiel. He is a professor of sociology at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. And his book is The Riddle of Amish Culture, and it's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press.